Peace. Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8. I'm now here with Vico Hesler. Now, Vico was one of my favourite guests last year, so I was eager to invite him back on. He is a writer. I discovered his material, I think, via Countercurrents, but he has his own website, which is linked below. Vico, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience, just for those people who don't know who you are.
Well, hello, Woes. It's great to be back. I'm not sure that many people will know me. I'm Vico Hesler. I write primarily on history, religion, and current affairs. I think most people will be familiar with me from Countercurrents, if they're familiar with me at all. But as you say, I also have my own website that you can view at transcendental-titans.net. I've been involved in the ethno-nationalist space for 15 years. And I primarily see my role as trying to boost the morale of the movement. I try and inspire people if I can, really. I mean, that's kind of my aim and my goal, really, in everything that I write. There's so much kind of depressing news, and there's so many people engaged in just amplifying all the decay in society. I kind of view my role, as I say, as a kind of, as a kind of antidote to that, essentially. So that's where I'm aiming from here. That's kind of where I write from.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Would you say that there's a tendency to over-focus on how bad things are? I'm not sure if I would say that myself, because I do think it's important to remain positive, especially, and I can say that because I have a tendency towards, well, depression. And or at least melancholy nowadays, not so much depression. But I do think it's important to try to stay afloat and try not to blackpill other people. Well, what would you say about that in terms of the state of the movement?
Well, I'd say my mission is to kind of white pill the masses, not to red pill them, in the sense that there's so much heavy artillery of the media and demoralization, and it's there, you know, it's there on purpose. And there are certain people within the movement, you know, in the Twitter space that just want to post the kind of grief porn. They want to post the kind of agonizing videos of people, you know, being hunted down. They want to just display the decay of society. And obviously, I don't want to give people false hope. I don't want to present the situation as better than it is. But at the end of the day, you have to offer an alternative worldview. You have to offer something positive that people can get behind and support. So just kind of fish mouth looking at the world, you know, aghast and saying, oh, that's really bad, isn't really the basis of a movement. And that's what I would say.
Yeah, indeed. I would agree with that. What would you said that you wanted to speak about the state of the discourse. So what do you mean by that? And you take it away.
Well, I mean, it's hard to comment on 2022 in the same way that we spoke about 2021, because, you know, there's no overriding topic. There's no sort of narrative this year, you know, as we had COVID last year. Although you could say that everything that's happened this year has actually been, in a sense, a kind of legacy or a progeny of COVID, from the kind of economic disaster to the revival of free speech. You know, we have an increasingly incoherent world without a mainstream narrative. You know, we have major questions going unanswered, whether it's Hunter Biden's laptop or, you know, who blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. There just isn't a kind of mainstream narrative anymore. There isn't a picture of the world that the elites are presenting to us. It's just going unanswered. So, you know, that's what I would say in terms of that. And there's I think also the case is the elites actually can't present a coherent picture of the world anymore, because they've spent a lot of their political capital in pushing falsehoods like COVID. You know, basically the lies that they're having to tell are so big now that they're really, you know, the average person isn't buying into them anymore. So there's been this kind of a collapse of the narrative, which has opened up the space. And in a certain way, it's odd, because, you know, we have a situation where what I call it, it's a kind of kaleidoscopic hall of mirrors where if you were to look at it on the surface, we have the same actors on the stage. So we have Trump, we have Farage, and, you know, we even have Milo back in the news. But it's kind of distorted and odd. You know, we have Trump selling NFTs. We have the kind of alt-light that's been released on Twitter by Elon, which is interesting. But I noticed that, you know, this certain individual was missing. I noticed that you're not been allowed back on there. That's JF. And, you know, I saw Greg Johnson was banned from there. So there's kind of a strange 2016 quality, but not for everyone. If I was to be a bit conspiratorial, I'm saying that I would say they're kind of suppressing the erudite voices while they're allowing on, you know, the kind of Jordan Petersons and the Andrew Tates and Andrew Angelins to say that they're in favor of free speech while at the same time kind of repressing any coherent narrative.
There's a lot there that I would agree with. I mean, I think, and I want to say, I don't really think that Andrew Anglin is incoherent. I just think that, just for the sake of clarity, but I think that he changes quite a lot and in quite an alarming way. And I'm not saying that he's a fake or anything, but I do understand what you're saying about people like Jordan Peterson, Andrew Tate. I mean, there are more that you could mention, alt-light. There's a lot in what you just said. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but there's a lot that's interesting. I think this concept of it's like 2016, but not really. It's the same actors. It's kind of like when you see the new season of a TV show and it's the same characters, but they've got different costumes this year. And the set is a bit different. And it doesn't quite, the theme tune's been altered or something. It's just not quite the same. And it's disorienting or disorientating. And so it's weird. Like Nigel Farage is still around. And yet it doesn't feel like he should be still around. Trump is still around, and yet it doesn't feel like he should be. It's kind of inappropriate. It's weird. And he has clearly changed. He is not the way he was in 2016. So there's a sort of uncanny valley thing there. Would you like to say anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of grotesque puppet show in a way where you've got Donald Trump, you know, shilling his NFTs in strange adverts. You've got Farage looking increasingly haggard, going in for his next Reform UK style CivNap kind of, you know, overture. And yeah, as you say, it's kind of almost, you know, in a way, it feels odd. It feels like people are trying to recapture the magic of that, but it's a kind of kaleidoscopic call of mirrors, distorted picture of it. And it seems like we're on one level trapped in stasis. But I think the difference is now, as we've seen with sort of the Kanye issues and the kind of whole stuff surrounding that there's been a loss of nuance, in a sense, where the nuance was an appeal to the center, which is completely collapsed. So people are just shouting the kind of most extreme positions now. There's no point really couching your language or your appeals in any kind of centrist tone. It's just all yes. Basically going out there for the most extreme position you can present, really.
I mean, I wouldn't want to endorse that, but I would say that it feels like the gloves are off at this point, and there's no like hiding your power level used to be a thing. And now I feel, especially after the Kanye West stuff, although even before then, I feel like it's kind of pointless. Like, even something like the JQ, I think that is not the forbidden knowledge that it was 5 years ago. I think that it's almost like everyone kind of knows that now. Everyone kind of knows about the JQ. And everyone kind of knows that multicultural... I mean, and this relates to something else you said, that the elites can't convey a coherent message because they're trying to cover up too many lies, hypocrisies, contradictions, disgraces, like the Hunter Biden laptop thing. So there's just so much damage control going on and so much bullshitting going on that there is no coherent worldview anymore. Would you like to say anything about that?
Yeah, I think in terms of Kanye and you know, what he said, I think the timing is more interesting than what he said in the terms of, you know, it kind of became a dam that burst. The people who were wielding power in that particular regard that power is best wielded from behind the curtains. And they were really pushed to the fore, whether it was sort of Sam Bankman-Fried or Greenblatt giving orders to Elon directly through via the ADL, or, you know, Joel Roth's kind of role being revealed. So I think it's a case of...
The extremeness of that is something else. That's amazing. I mean, shouldn't have interrupted.
No, I mean, it sort of became incontrovertible proof of something there. So, you know, it's kind of the man and the moment coincided where, you know, it became this question of, you know, why is that the case? And someone just spoke up and said that, you know. And so the timing is interesting there.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you never know how orchestrated these things are and at what level. My inkling is that Kanye West was really pissed off, and it probably had some, you know, what his ex-wife going with a Jewish guy might have had some motivational force there. I don't know, and it doesn't really matter. I mean, who cares? He's still alluding, he's still shedding light on something that is a real issue, regardless of what his reasons are.
I think his reasons are kind of deeper, actually. I mean,
I think they are as well.
I think the timing is interesting, because I think it's impossible to talk about Kanye West without talking about Jordan Peterson. And what I mean by that is they represent two ends of the Christian spectrum, you could say, Christian nationalism, where you've got the extremely philo-Semitic Jordan Peterson literally prostrating himself in Israel, saying that the future of the world depends on Israel. The other end of the spectrum, you've kind of got Kanye West taking up this neo-Lutheran criticism of Judaism. And when you think about Christianity, it's kind of a religion that's defined by its relationship to Judaism. And so you have this strange relationship where it can kind of go either way. So I kind of view them as two ends of a dialectic, really.
Yeah, I agree. What's happened with Jordan Peterson is interesting in itself. I mean, he has been mentioned on Millennial this year, but no one has really talked at length about him. I don't know if you would be inclined to do that. But to me, Jordan Peterson is a guy who, I mean, the previous guest said that identity and culture have to be rooted in a people. And I think this gets to the heart of why Jordan Peterson is mentally ill and depressed and crying all the time, and literally crying far more than a grown man should. It's not dignified. It's not right. It's clearly not healthy. He's clearly not a mentally healthy man. And I think it's precisely because he is so unrooted. So he's insisting on these values, he's insisting on these principles and these ideas, but he's also insisting that they cannot be rooted in an ethnos. And I think it's like a man trying to accomplish an impossible task. And I suspect that's the root of what's going on. As much as money is involved, I'm sure it is. Would you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I think you're getting at something there, that he's kind of an individual that can't square the circle in any regard. So he's a Christian that's not a Christian. He won't answer any direct questions about what he is or what he believes. He's been kind of put on this astroturf pedestal as a safety valve, in a sense, to draw people off. And his end conclusions are basically, you know, individualism, and they don't really contradict anything important in the actual overture of the modern world. And then he's kind of, you know, I think he's in a certain sense a victim of his success. And then he's hitched his wagon to the Daily Wire with Shapiro and become increasingly weird about its anonymity and the troll demons. And, you know, the sort of people, it's odd to me, the sort of people that criticize Kanye West for being incoherent and such like that, they often think that Jordan Peterson has more of a leg to stand on. But, you know, looking at his tweets and his kind of ongoing implosion, it's really no different from, you know, a B-list celebrity you'd see in rehab, really. It's kind of sad in a certain sense, but
that's a really funny idea that people talk about Kanye being incoherent, but I agree with you. the contradictions are just all over the place with Jordan Peterson. And I feel sorry for him, but I also think he really should just step aside. He really should just switch the camera off and, you know, go to a monastery for a year.
I do think Elon's kind of encouraging this, though. That if you look at the people he's kind of curated to come on, he's probably loving it because he's, you know, trying to drive engagement and have a bit of a cynical view of this. So someone, you know, a public intellectual, if we can call him that, having a never-ending meltdown about troll demons and anonymity and, you know, how much he loves Israel is kind of a spectacle, really.
It's absurd. And this gets back to what we were saying earlier, that there's a sort of circus-like feel about contemporary life, about public
That's why I, in my latest article, I compared it to Lewis Wayne's paintings as he sort of descended into madness, really, where it's almost a dreamlike or kind of nightmarish quality where it's people you know, but they're warped and twisted and doing odd and strange things, you know, and not acting in the same way. There's no kind of coherency to it. It's just very odd.
Yeah, indeed. And what's also concerning is how this attitude, how this atmosphere trivializes so much. When even Kanye West wearing that silly mask, you know, and then talking about stuff that is deadly serious, stuff that is extremely serious, but degrading himself as a speaker on, and thus the topics he speaks about, by dressing like that and then doing the stuff with the net and the Yahoo, you know. No.
Yeah, but I think the state of discourse kind of encourages that there's no bottom to it, and you may as well, you're kind of appealing to the TikTok generation's dopamine level, so you may as well just make the soundbite as extreme, as bombastic as possible. And as I say, you know, nuance in itself was, you know, caveating yourself or that was appealing to a kind of center that doesn't exist anymore. So as you say, that there's really no benefit to being nuanced. But I would warn people, and I have warned people, that we shouldn't really follow these pipers of pandemonium off a cliff. I think there's a quality on the right that's just chase the news and, you know, get behind the latest thing, but there's nothing really of substance there unless we push forward and make the substance.
Oh yeah, I completely agree. I mean, there's no need to join the circus. It would be silly to do that. I think this is a really interesting idea that you're saying, that there is no center to appeal to anymore, because you've probably heard about Academic Agent's thing about sensible centrism. Now, he's going to be on Millennials, so he'll talk about that himself. And I don't want to distort the concept or what he's going for. I'm not on Twitter, so I haven't kept up with all of the discourse on that. But do you think at this point that we should just be honest? I think we should, actually. I think I don't really feel the need. I mean, you know, obviously, social media rules aside, hate speech laws aside, I think we're at a point now where I think the public are, if not ready now, they are soon going to be ready to just hear unalloyed truth.
Well, I mean, we've seen the Overton window shift dramatically over the past 10, 15 years, you know, the anti-whiteism and, you know, woke becoming a kind of common term. And so, you know, we already saw it in that regard. So I think that there's a value to being honest and there's a value to telling truth. And the thing is, you know, as other people have pointed out, the costs for transgressing in minor ways are so extreme that you might as well tell the whole truth to a certain degree, because, you know, you've got people being arrested for misgendering on Twitter or, you know, these minor infringements, you know, people who don't even, they don't want to take on the system. They're not even trying to take on the system. They're just caught up in, you know, pushback and bizarre circumstance, really. And they're, you know, cancelled and debanked and deplatformed as much. So there is certainly a case for saying that you may as well just join the fray. And you know,
there's a phrase as well, caught with a sheep as a lamb, which I don't know if you know that, but it means that, well, if you're going to do the time, you might as well just go ahead. You might as well just do it. You might as well just go the whole hog, as it were. And I agree with you. There are people who, and it seems to happen quite a lot now, people fall foul of the rules without even intending to fall foul of the rules. So I cut you off there. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just basically agreeing, really, that, you know, as you say, yeah, that really you can fall foul of the rules so easily. I don't want to encourage people to just... The one thing that I kind of don't want to encourage is people to just go out there and say the most extreme things possible to try and to gain attention. I do think that we have to have a serious movement and we have to be trying to push goals. But my message really is that chaos is good for us. All this is good for us. If we were to just follow the demographic trends, if we were to have a mechanistic view of the world in which we were to say, well, you know, in X amount of years time, we'll be a minority or something like that. You know, we need this chaos because, although it's creating a lot of suffering and, you know, uncertainty, ultimately, there's no Marxist inevitability in our cause. There's no kind of we're going to win just because we're here. So, you know, there is chaos being generated and we need to get into the fray and push our point of view.
So would you advocate people create SOC accounts on Twitter or what? I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I do want people to get involved in the discourse, but I do primarily want people to kind of, I would say the model at the moment, and I have said this, I don't think it's realistic for everyone to become a political gladiator and jump into the fray, to be honest with you. I don't think that that's kind of desirable or feasible for most people, but I would kind of call it a hunter-gatherer system where if you can't directly, you know, contribute, there's ways to financially contribute, for example, to Countercurrents and to other institutions, to yourself, that's doing a lot of work where there's a lot of people in the system where they want to kind of take out of the system via donations and things like that. But they not a lot of people want to put in. But, you know, we need to build institutions. So whether that's Countercurrents or, you know, what you're doing here in terms of networking with people, they're going to be our kind of Noah's Ark in a sense of when things, you know, start to deteriorate. We do need those networks to be built. So I do encourage people to kind of, at the very least, donate, to comment, to engage with the discourse, and to try and network with people, because it's easier than ever to kind of get into these groups. And there's a lot of great events in real life as well that people get involved with as well. So, you know, you don't have to kind of wear a billboard and, you know, wander through the town square.
Indeed. Is there anything else that you would say about the, as you said, the state of the discourse?
I think basically, well, I've covered most of what I wanted to say in terms of that. You know, I think that the kind of repressive structures, we're experiencing a bit of a incidental thaw in free speech in the sense that the repressive structures have kind of collapsed. There's nothing in the center. And, you know, that's kind of what's funneling here. But I would encourage people again that just because there's chaos, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to win unless we put some effort in. You know, it's not the case. The interesting thing is the collapse of the mainstream has kind of meant that people have retreated into their echo chambers. And, you know, there's also all kind of bizarre conspiracy theories and, you know, these small groups that people operate in. You know, people don't watch the nightly news anymore, but they do have their Facebook groups and their kind of circles of friends that they operate in. So just because the mainstream discourse has collapsed doesn't necessarily mean that everyone's converted into, you know, reading Countercurrents and getting involved with the stuff. So we do need to get out there and push the message.
Yeah, I agree. And one thing that was mentioned earlier that I think helps in this regard is the contradictions. Actually, before COVID, I think it was one of my last speeches before COVID, and I was sort of dwelling on this topic at the time, and it's only amplified since COVID. And the theme is that we live in a world of lies. We live in a world where we are expected to constantly accept contradictions and half explanations, half truths, or often no explanations. I don't even know what the mainstream is saying about something like Hunter Biden's laptop, something like Hunter Biden's ridiculous photos, the obvious corruption there. I know that with the Twitter files, Elon Musk releasing the data about what was going on behind the curtain at Twitter, the mainstream media in America has just ignored it. They've barely talks about it, which and it should be a huge story, but they can't talk, they can't answer it. So therefore, they just don't talk about it. And this has happened with other things as well, where their modus operandi is simply to not mention the thing, not mention the thing that they can't explain away. Whereas previously, they would have ways to explain it away, or they'd have the morale, the ability, the expertise to explain things away dishonestly. But they would at least have it. They would do it. Or they would mock the people talking about it, something like that. Whereas
well, I think that they have less and less and less of an organ to actually speak through. You know, fewer and fewer people are looking at these mainstream sites. And the scale, as you say, the scale of the lies that they've had to tell have become, you know, so big that even the most disengaged person can say that it's not true. So you have this kind of absence of elite theory about the world. And I think also they spent a lot of political capital in terms of telling these lies, whether it was, you know, COVID falsehoods or things like that. And so they don't, no one trusts them. They have no organ to speak through. They have no kind of, you know, infrastructure really to convey the worldview. And perhaps in some sense, you know, they realize that perhaps it's just better to just say nothing. You know, there's so many people who have kind of vaccine regrets, and there's so many people who, you know, the thing is as well, it's impacted the material conditions of the world now. So we've got people in unheated homes. We've got people with, you know, refugee camps next door. We've got, you know, a war raging. So this kind of, I would say that really the crux of it is that the social contract has broken down. There's this view on the right that, you know, most people were kind of uninformed and they didn't know, and that's why they've gone along with it. But really the social contract's broken down. A lot of people were willing to be deceived as long as they gained some sort of material benefit out of it and the world carried on, the economy kept on moving. But, you know, there's no real advantage to being on their team anymore because they're not providing anything. You know, there's no furlough coming. We're living in a world of strife. So the argument that I've made is that the material conditions will bring more people to ideas than a thousand articles could do, because really, you know, a lot of people were just riding the liberal wave because they got something out of it and now they don't anymore.
Yeah, that brings us to the topic of Ukraine and Nord Stream. But before we get to that, I do agree with you that people were willing to be lied to as long as they got something out of it. I think that's a really good way of saying it. Let's go to Ukraine. Figuratively speaking.
Hopefully not literally.
What would you say about that war? Because this is a damn good example of something where the elites have to cover up so much bullshit. So what they've done is, and maybe this always happens with wars, I don't know. But certainly in this age, you've got America pretending to care about this country, this far-flung country at the other end of Europe, that is not, in theory, there's no real reason why America should care about it. And yet they do. And they're saying it's because Russia, because Putin is this crazed megalomaniac. And they've really cast him as just a villain, just like mad.
But I think they do care about it. And the thing is, they do care about it in the sense, not that they don't care about Ukraine or the Ukrainian people, but what they do care is this is kind of a meta-political struggle. It's an ideological clash of nations in a sense where what Russia represents is a kind of unreconstructed view of the world where power derives from tanks and energy. It's a kind of revanchist neo-imperial in power in some sense, where that it is challenging the ideology, and it's already become a kind of global conflict. Because if you see the operations that are going on in Iran, it's not just that we're at war with Russia, we're at war with all the Russia-aligned states. So you've got this kind of coalescing clash of civilizations where China and Iran and, you know, Russia and other states are being coalesced together and against the liberal order. So it is very important to them that they win. Obviously, they don't care in a sense about the Ukrainian people or that, but they do care about maintaining their hegemony, basically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's what it comes down to. It's that Ukraine is a proxy state where two two powers are having their war. And it, to some extent, it is a battle of ideologies, or rather, it's just a battle of powers. It's a, I think that's probably a better way to look at it, because, I mean, it's
well, I think as Dugin said, Russia doesn't really have an ideology to present. It's geographically bounded, whereas the West has had this kind of neoliberal world hegemonic ideology where we had the presumption that war is something that we did to third world countries to remake them in our image. You know, the liberal elite are perturbed because, you know, they'd built themselves up into this belief that war is something that we do to other people. You know, the borders of Europe were fixed in 1945 and immovable, but obviously states live because people make them, you know, make them what they are, and because people believe in them, they are imagined communities, so, you know, they can move. And that you know, once the first missiles were fired towards Ukraine, that just, you know, detonated all those assumptions. So that's kind of what's perturbed them there. And you know, the strange thing is that, you know, Russia isn't really offering an alternative worldview. I don't think we're going to see the Russian century, but they didn't update their geopolitical calculus. So there's, you know, positives and negatives of that, where I think, you know, there's a lot of comparisons between Putin and Hitler and the liberal media. But one of the comparisons that I do think is true, that Putin sensed a sort of weakness in the post-Afghanistan retreat malaise, and he thought that liberalism was a rotten structure, and if he kicked in the door, then the whole thing would collapse. And I don't think that's quite actually happened, really. There's a sort of surprising amount of resilience in the decadent empire. And, you know, that's interesting to observe.
Yeah, I think you're right that there has turned out to be more life in the old dog yet, so to speak, because America, I mean, a lot hinges on this. It's if Ukraine does fall to Russia. And I'm not saying that's even, I don't think that is what Russia wants. But if that did happen, if this war were lost by Ukraine, that would be seen as a refutation of America and America's view of the world. Similar to how America's withdrawal from Afghanistan, I think, was a refutation of America as a world power and its worldview, because they had tried to inculcate the Afghanis into, well, to be, what would you say, democratic consumers for the last 20 years, LGBT friendly and all that. And it,
well, it's kind of odd, because you've got two empires that are overreaching, in a sense. You had the American empire that overreached. You know, we have to kind of accept that the LGBT flag and all this kind of things in South Korea, there are a lot of states that do want to be part of the American empire in terms of soft power. You know, they are under the influence of the soft power. Where it all started to go wrong is when, you know, it started to use its hard power to invade countries like Iraq and Afghanistan that didn't want to be remade, and they didn't want to be part of the American empire. And that precipitated this kind of collapse and withdrawal. And Russia took that as an indication of weakness and launched this attack. I used the analogy of Occam's razor, where when people ask me why Russia attacked, I think, you know, it thought that it could win, and it thought it could get something out of this. It thought it could get the fertile soil of the Ukraine and the, you know, millions in terms of population out of there easily. But that's also been a Russian overreach as well, because, you know, there's a kind of Clausewitzian friction of war where, until people get the kit out and actually start fighting, you don't know what's going to happen. And there's, you know, the generals are always fighting the last war. So there's been a lot of developments in terms of, you know, kind of technological solutions to war, where it's almost this strange two-speed war, where on one sense you have drone warfare and, you know, HIMARS that are wreaking havoc, killing Russian generals. You know, you have 12 HIMARS that are basically kind of curtailing Russian forces, because there was this whole crowing that, you know, the West are killing Russian generals. And that, I think in people's minds, they had the idea that it was a human Soviet human wave and Russian generals are being killed. But they're actually being geolocated by, you know, Western intelligence. And what it's proven is a lot of technologies that we thought were value neutral aren't. So, you know, payment systems, GPS, things like that, that you think, you know, you kind of have this view that they're value neutral and they just exist in some space, but actually they're Western and they're controlled by us. And then, you know, you have a Russian army that can't, you know, function in terms of basic map security, and, you know, they're being targeted by the West. So you have this technological element to it, but then you also have the element where I don't know if you've seen the images, but if you look around Bakhmut, it's World War One trench warfare. And, you know, you kind of have these two speeds happening simultaneously.
Yeah, there's a thing that people say that modern warfare is technology, and it's someone, you know, it's like some lesbian with blue hair pushing a button, and a thousand miles away, an explosion happens, you know, the drone fires and all that. But actually, that's not quite true, is it? I mean, it's still, to a great extent, you know, there's still violence. There's still...
Well, the Western conception of warfare, I mean, this has been covered in academic articles, that the Western, you know, conception of warfare is basically that it's a technological problem to be solved. And you can see that in the approach to Afghanistan, where, you know, if we just had a bigger bomb, or if we just had more drone coverage, we could win this. But there's a will, and there's a... You know, at the end of the day, there, whatever you think about Zelensky and that regime, and there are Ukrainians on the ground, and they're fighting, and they're freezing in the cold, and they want to be a nation. And it's very difficult to overcome that, really. You can't, you know, kind of sleight of hand that away by technical means. At the end of the day, it's still boots, bullets, and, you know, tanks on the ground. What's changed, really, is obviously you have, in terms of, you know, combined arms warfare and modern warfare, I think the Russians are suffering from the fact that you can't really have autarky anymore. You can't have, you know, autarky in the sense that their defense industry just can't keep up. You know, a lot of these Western weapons are the products of, you know, collaboration. And so they don't have, like, the native drone capacity. They don't have the kind of ability to sustain this warfare.
Yeah, I saw someone saying today that Russia had fired 40 missiles into Ukraine, and 37 of them were intercepted by Ukraine's own system. It was just something I saw. I don't know if it's true. But either way, I think you're right that this has turned out to be a much harder war than the Russians assumed. One other aspect to this, which you alluded to, Russia being removed from the SWIFT system. So that was something that we thought, you know, everyone just assumed that it's like a fact of life. It's almost like the wind or the water. It's just there. It's not ideological. It doesn't belong to any one party, and it will not. It doesn't. It's like facts don't care about your feelings. SWIFT doesn't care about your ideology. Well, but actually, Russia has been removed from it. So the question I'm going to ask you is, what do you think about the statement that globalism is not actually global? It's really just the collective enterprise of the West and Western countries.
Yeah, I think that really gets to the crux of it. That, I mean, one of the things that's gone by the by is that we were constantly told that there's this liberal democratic peace theory where two countries that have McDonald's will never go to war. We're too integrated to ever have a war. And, you know, that was one of the big shocks for, I think, Western policymakers, is we thought we'd done away with war in terms of Europe, in terms of developed countries where they have too much to lose. And in a sense, it's probably true that, you know, they do have a lot to lose. And we have seen that, you know, Russia has lost certain things. But, you know, as liberal hegemony is collapsing, you know, I call it the revenge of the periphery. There's so many countries that aren't part of this global order. There's so many, you know, actually, when you look at it in terms of raw numbers, the vast majority of the countries aren't part of this global order, and they don't really necessarily benefit from it. So you've kind of had this rise of the malcontents that, you know, they don't really necessarily want to be part of it. And increasingly, as we have less to offer, you know, the American empire and all these kind of peripheral things have been a luxury, really. They've been a product of, you know, our economic successes and the pet projects, really. You know, and so we're going to increasingly not be able to offer those countries anything. And so they're going to make their alternative systems. You know, I think Russia's already working on its alternative payment systems. And I think a lot of countries are going to be watching from the wings here and seeing that, as you say, things that we consider to be value neutral and just, you know, globalist and kind of coherent pillars of the modern world, there's going to be fragmentation. There's going to be kind of, you know, different camps and compartments going on.
Yeah. So you end up with quite a mixed picture where America is more powerful than we thought it was, but the other powers are also rising. So America cannot just punish them in the way that it used to be able to do that. So removing Russia from the SWIFT system doesn't actually screw Russia. Because it's Russia. This is a point that was made, that you can deplatform an individual and it will massively impact their life, certainly in terms of being able to take part in the discourse or whatever. But deplatforming a huge country like Russia from an international system, well, then that huge country has the resources to just build a new international system. And that, as you say, that seems to be what's happening with, I think it's with India and China, that Russia's doing that. So you end up with a very mixed picture then. It's not like, well, America is still in the world policeman. It kind of is, but it's like he's got a limp now, something like that.
Well, that's why they're desperately trying to punish Iran, because, you know, you look at countries like Turkey and Iran that have developed their own drone systems, their own armaments industries, and they're providing alternatives to the West, essentially. So, you know, once you cut Russia out of a system, you know, there'll be alternative buyers. India is buying their gas and their oil, for example. So, as you say, you can deplatform them, but it kind of carries on. And they've always been this approach where Russia's half in the system, but half not. And, you know, a lot of states have been kind of ostracized and, you know, economically squeezed by the West for various reasons. So, yeah, that's kind of the end result that you get there.
Yeah. In terms of our own countries, you mentioned the Nord Stream thing. What do you think happened with Nord Stream? Just for the sake of clarity, what do you think? Who do you think did it?
I think it's hard to say in some sense, but I mean, I think it was clearly some sort of Western backed operation, whether it was Ukraine directly or the Americans, strangely, I mean, one of the big losers of this whole conflict has been Germany, really, where, you know, they'd invested so much in terms of being this economic power, without any military power. You know, you had them sending moldy missiles to Ukraine. None of their divisions are serviceable, and they've been one of the real losers here, where, you know, they were dependent on Russian energy. They didn't really want to fight for the Ukraine, but they've been forced into being aligned with it by America. And I think that's just kind of an extreme example of this, where America's kind of strong arming them back into line, really. And as you say, that was really the beginning where I thought there's no mainstream narrative anymore, because if you ask most people who blew up Nord Stream pipeline and why, they just, you know, they'd either say it's Russia, which doesn't make any sense, or they say, I don't know. So that was kind of the beginning for me where things really started to get incoherent, because that's a massive international incident. I mean, if it is the case that America blew up that infrastructure, then they effectively committed a hostile action against a third party, but that's not investigated or cared about. And, you know, but then again, no one really knows, as definitively said, the origin of COVID or spoken about Hunter Biden's laptop or anything like that. So, you know, it is increasingly a world where the answers just aren't offered, and best not to ask, really.
Yes, I agree. I think, and this gets to the heart of what we were saying, you know, we have this situation now where people cannot any longer expect to switch on the TV and hear a summary of the truth and a summary of what's actually happened. I think it's astonishing that we can't, like, there isn't a universal assumption that Nord Stream was blown up by Western powers, or probably almost certainly America, or at least under the auspices, like under the direction of America, at the request of America. I don't see why Britain would do it. I don't believe that Poland would have the resources to do it. And I don't think it would. I think it was America, possibly Britain, acting under the authority, the orders of America to do this. And yet no one seems to be able to just say that. You know, certainly not in the mainstream, because that would give away the whole thing, that America actually isn't a benign world policeman. It's it's a power that is prepared to screw over its own allies. I mean, you said it's a hostile act against the third party. It's a hostile act against its own ally.
You know, yeah, I mean,
it's serious.
Yeah, exactly. It's massively serious. But, it's I think what it demonstrates is there's a kind of belief on some fringes of the movement that our enemies are monolithic and all-powerful and, you know, infallible, but they've really lost control of the narrative. And I think the reason why there's radio static in terms of explanations for this is because things are developing so quickly and are so chaotic, and they don't have the kind of infrastructure and, you know, institutional capital to even come up with narratives for this. And so, you know, for me, it's kind of white pilling in the sense that, you know, the elites are vulnerable. They can't explain everything away. They can't just they can't offer the same worldview that they did to people, you know, in the past, where they turn on nightly news and the explanation offered is the explanation, and we go along with it because things have become too chaotic. They've become too messy, and they're developing too quickly. And I just don't think that we have the kind of Machiavellian leadership capacity in a sense to kind of navigate these waters. So that's why we've got this strange situation now where, you know, there's this radio silence when you ask about any of these things. And you know, if you ask someone in the street what happened, they probably get 10 different answers.
Yes indeed. Well, I guess that brings us to the final topic that you wanted to talk about, which is the general state of Britain. It seems likely to me, just on one thing that, I mean, you could talk about many things here, but one thing is, if Germany, the state of affairs there seems to be that Germany is going to have to scale down its industrial operations, its industry. That's going to have, I mean, I've even heard that Germany will have to deindustrialize, and I don't really know what that will mean. What does that look like? It's unimaginable. A Europe without an industrial powerhouse of Germany. But either way, if that does happen, and I don't see any reason why it won't, then that's going to have massive repercussions for the rest of Europe, and including Britain, which in turn means that, well, our economy is going to be hit by this. And that's to say nothing of the legacy damage of the COVID lockdowns. But, you know, I don't want to be completely miserableist about this. I'm just wondering, what would you say about the general state of Britain going forward?
Well, I think we're in a very serious situation, really, where there's almost a cultural whiplash where things were on a certain trajectory, and they've changed even, you know, on a dime. And I think the UK has almost become one of the most basket case countries, where you had the Liz Truss episode. And the most interesting thing about that, talking about the economy, is not necessarily, you know, her complete ineptitude and things like that. It's the fact that the budget that she wanted to implement, the cost, the mini budget that she wanted to implement, wasn't actually defeated from within. It was defeated from without by speculation on the pound, by IMF intervention. So not only do we live in a country where, you know, we've got 70,000 people running across the border, you know, and turning up on these boats, but you can't even set a base tax policy, whether that's correct or incorrect, without these kind of globalist hyenas speculating and you know, kind of coming in. So that's an interesting legacy for me, for her, in terms of that. And we have this unelected prime minister, which not even their own party voted in. We have the Electoral Commission denying Patriotic Alternative, as far as I'm aware, to become a political party. So, you know, we're kind of in strange, uncharted waters. And yeah, you say the economy, I mean, the kind of euphemism that they're using at the moment is that we're under the auspices of these global headwinds. Well, the global headwinds are, in fact, the hangover from COVID, aren't they? I mean, whatever kind of dressing that they try and put on, whether it's the energy crisis or Ukraine, Putin's war or Brexit, actually, you know, essentially the massive spending that we did in terms of the COVID policies and the furlough, 80%, you know, remember Eat Out to Help Out and the massive splurging that went on there. Now we're in a situation where, you know, everyone's on strike, nurses are on strike, and they're asking for 20% increase, 19% increase. Well, that's, you know, that's a kind of hyperinflationary spiral that we're in here. So, you know, regardless of what happens in Germany, and I think Germany has more deep-seated problems in terms of their demographic. I think the implosion of Germany is essentially a demographic implosion, that they've got the oldest, one of the oldest kind of median ages in Europe, and there's just no one coming up to fill that, industrial base. So, you know, the people that they have imported, obviously that hasn't panned out. And, in the UK, we had the census figures here that there's almost 10 million foreign nationals in the UK. Well, I mean, that, that has catastrophic implications for what the UK is. I'm kind of frustrated with British nationalism in a sense that it doesn't seem to be a core to it. There's kind of a inherent contradictions where it's all a lament. You have these kind of Douglas Murray and, Peter Hitchens types that just say that it's all over, it's all finished. I'm kind of heartened by the revival of Jonathan Bowden in the internet space, where, you know, we want to clear them out. We want to clear them all out. We want radical nationalism. We don't want Farage and Reform to tinker around the edges. There's an obfuscation. If you look at the UK, this discourse around Albanians, for example, what happens in British nationalism is they never talk about the actual issue. They never say, listen, there's 10 million foreign nationals in the UK. They say, oh, well, you know, there's Romanians and Bulgarians coming in, and, we might make some bilateral agreements to get rid of them. Well, we want a radical solution. We want a kind of Bowdenesque solution. We want, someone to come and clear them out. I'm kind of sick of these laments.
Oh, I agree. I think the point of the clear them out thing is we don't trust these people. And they've shown themselves to be disinterested and incompetent and overwhelmed by other powers. So they're not fit for purpose. And we just want to get rid of them. I just want them out of office. I mean, that's a very... it's very clear. I want to be careful about Fed posting here, but obviously the attitude that politicians have had over the last few decades, really the last 100 years, is not fit to take on.
It's not just the politicians, though. There's a fundamental problem with British nationalism, where I attended one of the last speeches that Roger Scruton made. And he said, you know, you just have to find things in the UK to love. And you have this kind of Peter Hitchens lament where it was all over, in 1950 or 1920. And there's nothing. The problem is, what is British nationalism? You know, it's kind of Spitfires and Churchill, and, it's not vital. It's not vibrant. If you look at, for example, Serbian nationalism, you look at something like Kosovo is Serbia. That's, that encapsulates so much in just a slogan. It's vital, and it's revanchist, and it's kind of, it means something. It embodies a people, whereas British nationalism is just this kind of this timid lament of, well, I wish there was fewer of them. I wish, things were a bit better. We need to kind of move past this. We need a vehicle. We can't just have Reform UK again with Farage coming in saying that, we might do something this time, and we're going to really squeeze the Conservatives this time. And we need to move beyond that.
I agree. I mean, ideally, it would be something that really invigorated people and spoke of something current, something future, and something beautiful, and not something dead. I mean, the Blitz spirit and all that, you can walk around London today, the people, and this is a horrible thing to say, actually, but, the people who lived through the Blitz, they're not in London anymore. So that is something that, and with all of the implications of that, they've been replaced.
Well, I mean, let's say it plainly, the Cockneys were essentially ethnically cleansed. And what's weird is you look at Hollywood movies and they have the kind of Cockney gangster and all those kind of motifs going on. But if you actually go to London, London's an odd space because, as long as you're in the 5 miles of the centre, it's actually quite nice. But everything out that is increasingly becoming a hellscape. And you had the BBC kind of running cover. The classic, it all devolves into this argument where Farage pointed out, Leicester is not white. Luton is not white. Manchester is no longer white. Birmingham's no longer white. And the BBC came back and they said, oh, well, actually, if you aggregate all of the, you know, European whites and the gypsies that are also included in the white category, it is white. And that's kind of missing the point. They're talking past us where, you know, we don't want a situation where London is 30% white British. That's unsustainable.
It's intolerable. I mean, it's outrageous. And I'm sure there are ways that you can cook the books, fiddle the numbers, and find out that, well, whatever. But you only have to...
Well, in France, they just simply stopped having census results. And obviously, that was another claim that Farage made, that they're going to start either gerrymandering the census or just simply stop reporting the results. And they immediately came out and said they haven't made any decisions on it and stuff like that. So,
they're
trying to run ahead of the criticism there.
Yeah, the ONS said that they would stop reporting that data. Now, I remember David Blunkett 10 years ago saying that he was on, I think it was on Question Time, and he said that he thought we should stop reporting this data because it just encourages racism. Well, of course it does, because the data says that we are being replaced in our own homeland. So what do you expect? I mean, people are going to get surprised and outraged by that. The issue is not the reporting of the problem. The issue is the problem itself. So, I mean, this goes to show how corrupt our politicians are, that they think, well, we'll just stop reporting the problem. We'll just stop talking about that thing that we don't want people
to I think you kind of need to divorce yourself from the idea that the politicians or we must at this point divorce ourselves from the idea that any politician in the mainstream is ever going to solve this issue.
I don't want to sound too naive about this. I'm fully aware that these people are charlatans.
Yeah, I mean, but that's what I'm advocating for. We need a vehicle. I mean, we're kind of in some ways in a worse position than we were 10 years ago in terms of the electoral politics of the situation, where you did have the BNP, and for all its faults, you know, it was gaining seats, and it was a kind of national electoral party, and it operated. And we don't have anything like that. You know, we don't even have these populist parties that have gained power in Sweden and in Italy. Now, I have my own problems with them because I think they don't solidify power, and they just, you know, they're trapped in this paradigm that, you know, 51% of the people might vote them in and they just lose power. But we don't even have that option at the moment. So we're kind of, you know, at sea, you know, it's sinking Britannia without a real solution. And I would appeal to patriotic alternative. I don't know what their current kind of... thought processes, but they do need to kind of step up to the plate, I think, in that sense.
Well, I wouldn't want to comment on that. I think the problems with them are with the Electoral Commission, that the Electoral Commission can basically just keep fucking them around indefinitely.
It's almost a rerun of the BNP constitutional issue that was sunk the party, where because there was a clause in the constitution that people had to be of a certain ethnic origin, that was kind of the writing on the wall for them. And from what I understand, patriotic Scots and have been kind of trapped in this limbo where every time they go, they find a new reason to deny them. I'd almost be inclined to say, at this point, submit almost a blank constitution and just get the party approved. And the thing is, without having an organ, without having an institution, you can't gain the kind of electoral, visibility. Obviously, there's certain entitlements where they had to run electoral broadcasts for the BNP on national TV, for example. My advice to them, and obviously, you know, I'm sure that they're working on this and they're thinking about this themselves, but my advice to them would be, at this point, would almost be submit a blank constitution and then just go for it.
That might well be an option. I think that another issue is just funding. For one reason or another, if you're going to take part in the game of politics, the public discourse, lobbying, campaigning for stuff, money helps, and so you need big donors. You need people who can inject large amounts of cash into these things. And for whatever reason, this is something that, you know, it is saddening that there just don't seem to be millionaires and billionaires willing to invest large amounts of money in this stuff, because I guess because they're worried about being identified. And and I mean, look what's happened to Elon Musk. You know, that's it's unfortunate, but you know, the hope is that these people will understand the gravity of the situation. This is not just about your own personal wealth or your empire. We're talking about the survival of the white race and the European, all of the peoples of Europe, and the survival or rejuvenation of that thing that we call Western civilization. It's pretty fucking important.
Well, I think in his own very mediated way, Elon Musk did elucidate this the other day when he said, you know, we must defeat the woke mind virus. So there is a kind of nascent acknowledgement of this, obviously not in the terms that you've just outlined there. I mean, they wouldn't couch it in those terms. But I think, I think that there will be, I think just as ordinary people were collaborating with the system because they got some benefit out of it, as the system becomes increasingly dysfunctional, it also doesn't serve certain elites, you know, as there's less ability to actually produce economic growth to kind of, you know, line their pockets in a sense, where they're going to be more open to veering off in these directions. So I'm kind of, I wouldn't necessarily say optimistic that someone's going to come and, you know, fund this show or start being my patron for my articles anytime soon. But I do think there is a somewhat of a nascent movement in this direction. You see it with, although I don't really like him and I'm not really kind of much care for the candidates they put forward, you know, Peter Thiel, and there are kind of turns in this direction that could produce something interesting ultimately.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that. I mean, we are not in the situation we were in 10 years ago or 5 years ago. Farage did explicitly say white, and that's interesting.
Yeah, I think, the discourse has moved on a lot. You can go up to someone now and say that's anti-white or that's woke, or, you know, you can talk about these things openly, and they're just acknowledged now. I think they're too blatant to be ignored, and also, you know, everything has become so polarized, they've moved forward with their agenda so quickly that you know, it's almost uncontroversial to say these things. It might be controversial in the sense of, you know, the mainstream discourse and the feigned outrage, but to be quite honest with you, most people know what's happening.
Could you elaborate on that? I mean, what do you mean when you say most people know what's happening?
Well, you look at the census data, and you know, to be honest with you, most people, they'll have their opinion one way or the other. They'll say, you know, you've got the kind of copers who are saying, or the deniers who will say, well, you know, it doesn't matter if Britain becomes non-white, you know, who cares? And then you'll have the people who are polarized by it and galvanized by it. That's why you have this polarized society where it's almost a 51-49%, where, you know, if I went up to 10 people in the street and said, what do you think about Britain becoming a non-white country? The four of them might say they don't care, or probably be non-white anyway, and six will say, I don't want that. So it's becoming kind of entrenched, you know. That's why I'm advocating for, we need to kind of move the discourse along a bit and be more, you know, we kind of need to look towards solutions and institutions and networks, rather than just kind of rehashing the same things that we've been saying.
Yeah, I agree. I think analysing the problem does have limits to its usefulness. But at the same time, the problem keeps evolving, and it's difficult. I mean, look what happened with COVID. That I would never have predicted that. And then now this year, with Ukraine, especially the Nord Stream and the repercussions of all that. I mean, life is changing. I think life is going to change. And so, as much as I agree that there should be practical activity, like practical solutions and building and all that, I also think there's I mean, it would be ridiculous not to talk about what's going on. Not to
I don't by any means think that we should stop talking about the issues. But what, you know, what I don't want people to do is be kind of deer in headlights, just looking at these kind of evolving things. So there is chaos. I mean, it's undeniable that there's new chaos unfolding. You couldn't model it on a statistical model. You couldn't computer model it. You know, if we were having this conversation 3 years ago, it'd be completely different. And that's white pilling to me, because as I've said, if we have a purely mechanistic, deterministic view of the world and we just say, well, we're going to go into extinction and there's nothing we can do about it. But if there's chaos, you know, there's going to be suffering, and there is suffering, and there's an increase in suffering, and many good things are going to be lost. But there's also an opportunity that unexpected things can happen. And there's also opportunities for us, and people are going to be more open to our message than ever, because material conditions are declining. People are more aware of the problem in terms of just look around. They, you know, the thing is, there used to be a kind of social contract where if you lived in London, you know, it was multicultural, that's for you, fine, that you'd agree to that. But now if you live in a small town, you live, you know, in Skegness, you didn't vote for migrant hotels there. You didn't vote for that. You know, if you live in a small seaside town and you're watching people run up the beach, the thing is, you know, that's 70,000 that have come in via the dinghies and things have probably done more to radicalize people than all the, you know, legal migration that's come in, because it's just so blatant, so
I agree.
Obvious.
I actually suspect that a fair percentage of the population are currently waiting for a strong man to emerge, because to sort all of this out. Because when you see, and I'm not saying anything that my audience won't already be thinking here, so I don't think I'm going to be radicalizing anyone with these words, but when you see the footage of especially villages with the newcomers in them, it's difficult not to think, my God, we are really being replaced and there is nowhere left to run. There is no white flight two anymore. And that's the idea.
That's the turning point where, as I say, you know, there was kind of a tacit agreement that, well, if you live in a big city, that's just what, you know, as Sadiq Khan said, that's part and parcel of it. But now, you know, the people who have opted out of it, who didn't want that, are being forced to have it. And so what are your alternatives there? You either resist it or... Yeah, as you say, then you accept it and you shut up. So I think people are being forced to face that conundrum, really.
Yes, I agree. I mean, it is getting real in a way that for a lot of people, it simply wasn't 5 years ago or even 3 years ago. And part of this also is the energy shortage. The stuff that's happening now... As we said earlier, as long as there's luxury, or was this maybe with the previous guest, as long as there's luxury, people can just delude themselves. I really think that life is changing. And I said this about COVID, that I think it locked people into the here and now. It stopped them thinking about their future, their own personal life plans. And I think that's just increased, actually, ironically. It's a different... type of event, very different type of event with the Ukraine war and Nord Stream, but it's had this similar effect. It's exacerbated the same maladies that, well, okay, we're not going to be wealthy anymore. We're not going to have a consumer paradise. We're not going to have the decadence that we've known all our lives. That's over now. And so people, I think, are going to... Well, I think it's going to change people's horizons and make them think much more realistically about what is about their situation, about their society. It's not academic anymore, and it's not distant anymore. It's everywhere now.
Yeah, I think there's two aspects to that. One, the rise of Christian nationalism, which we've seen in terms of Kanye and Nick Fuentes. I think it's interesting the timing of that, because milquetoast Christianity, you know, the kind of mainstream Christianity has collapsed, but we have this age of anxiety where people are looking for new metaphysical kind of struts to hang themselves to, because the world is getting, you know, much less coherent. And I think most people realize that things, at least in the short to medium term, definitely aren't going to get better. You know, the energy crisis, we have this strange paradoxical situation where there was an announcement that we've finally, you know, made fusion power work. But for most people, you know, we're sat here on unheated homes who can't afford the energy bills. You know, there's situations where in European countries, you know, the energy doesn't work today because it wasn't windy. So, you know, yeah, there's this a kind of return to basics and a return to reality where we've lived in this gilded cage, as I call it, you know, where we had that luxury to be. Well, I would say even immigration, to be quite honest, it was a luxury, really. I mean, that's becoming another issue where while we had an economy that was growing exponentially, you know, people kind of turned a blind eye to it. But as the economy contracts and as real world conditions decline, then people aren't going to be open to it in the same way that they were, because it was just a kind of a luxury. And I see on the right now a kind of return to basics where there's people exploring paganism, you know, Christianity. You know, I'm personally a kind of a proponent of Janus as a dialectical means to bring people back to faith. And you know, there's explorations of faith. There's these kind of things that you probably wouldn't have a conversation about so much 5 years ago, because we are facing a deteriorating world, and we've kind of got to find coping mechanisms. We've got to find you know, foundations for action.
Yeah, I agree. Is there anything else you'd like to say about the general state of Britain before we go to the questions?
No, I think I've basically covered everything there. You know, I do think that the situation is pretty grave, and we don't necessarily have the alternative that I would like. But as I say, that my mission is really to kind of white pill people. And I do think that from what I've seen, there's more people talking about it. There's more openness and there's more opportunity. We just need people to come together to network, to make the vehicles. You know, we kind of... you know, we have all the infrastructure there. Just getting people to get involved, really.
Okay. I mean, I agree that it is always good for people to come together and collaborate. That's I certainly agree with you on that. And this situation is not going to. I was going to say it's not going to get better of its own accord. I think to some extent that's not entirely true, because in a sense, as you said, reality is red-pilling people all the time. And what we need to do is be there to provide explanations for them so that they understand what is going on. Because a lot of people still perhaps operate with the assumption that the government is there to look after them and their society is benign and non-corrupt. I think there's going to be a lot of people having a terrible rude awakening, you know?
This is one of the problems with the British public, is that they don't. The reason they've been so kind of slow on the uptake is, you know, they want to have, you know, this fundamental sense of fair play and politeness and everyone getting along. And, you know, sometimes when they say that Britain is a tolerant country, they're kind of right in the sense that, you know, most people, they don't want this. You know, they'd wish this would just go away. It's you know, not an issue they want to deal with. And it's, you know, Britain is not by nature a radical country given to radical solutions. You know, it's kind of, you know, it's staked its whole history on being, you know, middle of the road in terms of these things. And, you know, it's rejected radicalism a lot of the time. But unfortunately, you know, things will have to change, because that's the way that the world is.
Yes. Sorry, I was just typing something there. Yes, I agree. People are going to have to wake up to this. And as I say, I think our role is to be there and ready for them when they wake up. And I do think it's happening. I mean, it's not like, it was a million people last year came into the country. This is astonishing.
This is the thing about the kind of threadbare nature of democracy is the majority of people voted for Brexit, and Brexit was a proxy vote to reduce migration, and yet we have the highest migration levels that we've seen ever, pretty much. So, you know, again, it's a loss of narrative control. It's just, you know, a one for one. How could you possibly ever defend that, you know?
Yeah, and someone's just said in the live chat, do people really not understand that most people are NPCs at this point? Life is a matter of a minority of ideologues fighting over the masses of sheep. Yeah, you're right. But what we're saying here is that the powers that be are losing that ability to transmit messages convincingly to the masses. And I think they are. I think that the masses are more detached, much less trusting of the government than they were 10 years ago. And the main, as you've just said, Vico, the main reason for that is that we got Brexit formally, but not really. I mean, it hasn't worked out.
Yeah, I mean, the comments are there. They're kind of onto something. I wouldn't formulate it quite like that. I would say that the people are more open to a vanguard now because their current elites failed them. I mean, fundamentally, people just, not everyone's a political gladiator. You know, they just want things to function, and they want the trains to run. They want the post not to be on strike. They want to live in a fairly affluent society. They don't necessarily have the kind of prescriptions that we have. And the government's failing them. And so they're going to be more open to vanguard elites with different solutions.
Yes, I agree. Okay, we'll get to the questions then. Black Pigeon Pilled asks, does Vico rate reform under Tice?
No. I mean, I've listened to Tice in person, and I also get the correspondence from Reform. I find Tice to be this kind of non-entity, frustrating. You know, he was tweeting the other day just nonsense about, if it's climate change, then why is it so cold? When, you know, really, you kind of need to be tackling the issues in a more of a erudite way. And I think, it's a party that's constantly asking you to vote on its principles. They don't actually have any ideas. They're just waiting for ours to come back. It's just a blank container, really. And they're not going to solve the issue. I mean, they're worth voting for as a protest vote to pressure the Conservatives, but they don't appeal to me.
No, definitely not. I mean, this was a thing that someone said about Nigel Farage's new, I forgot what it was called, or if he even had a name, but he was talking about creating a new party, and he was talking about, it might have been Reform actually, but this was a few months ago, and it said what he would like, what he stands for, and what he thinks a new party should stand for, and it was just libertarianism. It was just a lot of the same forces and processes that have got us to the position that we're now in.
Tice and Farage are sometimes a bit like Skinner, you know, the Simpsons meme of "Tell me what to say." You know, they're kind of these blank. They're in the business of chasing public opinion rather than setting it sometimes.
Yeah, and this is all, even though Farage is clearly aware of demographic replacement, even if he doesn't, I'm not saying that he's a white nationalist or even a nationalist of any kind, but he clearly is aware of what's going on. And yet his default, the thing he defaults to is, well, we need more libertarian. We need more just something to shut up these wokies. That seems to be the extent of his thinking on this. So I agree that he and Richard Tice, these, you know, I don't want to say that, you know, they're a pair of gormless boomers, but I do think, I mean, because, you know, I people can wake up at any age, but I suspect that for whatever reasons, these guys are sort of locked in a way of thinking that could have solved the problem 30 years ago, but will not solve the problem today.
Well, they're out of their era. I mean, it's funny that both, Trump was shilling NFTs and Farage was on Cameo, doing paid announcements for people. You know,
yes.
They're kind of chameleons and survivors, and they'll say what needs to be said. I do have some respect for Farage in the sense that, he has actually kind of implemented political change from the fringes without ever being elected. And, you know, he's been dogged in doing that. But he's not the solution that he's not the end point. He's kind of the midpoint that we need to build on and move from. And also he's just looking increasingly haggard. And I think he's kind of bewildered. People live beyond their epoch to a degree. And again, you know, some of the points, for example, you know, in America, where there's this appeal to free speech and the Constitution, well, increasingly those things aren't respected in the same, you know, same way in the UK, that a lot of the points that Farage is appealing to, you know, common courtesy and, you know, sensible kind of solutions aren't really privileged anymore here.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, let's see these. One-eyed fat man says, Vico talks of liberal collapse, but how quickly does he think this will come about? Has the system got closer to 5 or 50 years before major system collapse?
I think the system could limp along for a long time. I mean, you know, it's almost the system becomes a shell of itself. You look at South Africa, there's functionally a government and there's functionally these things, but in reality, the situation is quite different. So, you know, but also at the same time, you know, I've said before, the Soviet Union existed and then collapsed within the blink of an eye. So it is, in the age of chaos, it's hard to say, really. You know, we could see cataclysmic change. And I think, it could be top down in the sense that the elites are really struggling to control the narrative and keep it together. And, it could be a collapse from the top as much as an uprising from the bottom, to be honest with you. So there's that opportunity. But then again, you know, unfortunately, we could have a situation where it limps along, everything becomes less functional, the government's still in Westminster, but everything's collapsing, and you know, it's kind of a chronic, I mean, I use this term chronic politics, where in this polarized period, nothing actually really gets done. Everything's exhausted in the discussion of it. So we will talk about things, but nothing's ever actually implemented because, you know, everything, the bureaucracy is too corrupted and there's actually no will to implement anything.
Yeah, I agree. You see, I think that what's happened with Elon Musk sort of gives me hope about this because it shows that things can change. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that Elon Musk is, you know, based Elon or that he's the God Emperor or whatever, but he's clearly not in the tent in the same way that Trump clearly wasn't in the tent. I mean, even though he was connected to it and it had been in it and all that, they clearly hated him viscerally. And I think the same is true now of Elon Musk, especially after his purchase of Twitter, even though he hasn't done anything really radical there. And I think this shows that all is not lost. I mean, the system is not capable of controlling all of the players, browbeating all of them. And again, what's happened with Kanye West is another example of that. He is a loose cannon.
The system is by no means monolithic. As I said previously, there's this idea of, you know, some people think that, you know, everything is a plan and everything is a psyop and everything, you know, the government is all powerful and the globalists are all powerful. But in reality, they clearly don't want Elon to be doing what they're doing. They don't want him to release the Twitter files. They wish that he hadn't purchased it. They don't want him to allow the people back on that he has allowed back on. And he's also, I think, in a strange way, been radicalized by the user base. You know, it's almost like the old adage that all comment sections become right wing eventually. And I think that he's kind of got high on his own supply to a degree where he's been encouraged by the feedback that he has when he, you know, makes these kind of statements, and it's emboldened him.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still not optimistic about, you know, the amnesty on Twitter or whatever. But
well, no, I do think, I mean, you know, I they haven't allowed you back on. They haven't allowed JF back on. I think they banned Greg Johnson, they recently.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
So it was a big fanfare where, you know, these bigger names, I think these bigger names were almost running cover where, well, we've allowed, I think Andrew Anglin, to go back to our earlier conversation, you know, he was kind of the furthest flagpole where it's like, well, we've allowed Andrew Anglin back on, so obviously we're in favour of free speech, but then obviously you're still banned and many other people are still banned. So.
Oh, yeah. I actually,
in fact, you're worse than Andrew Anglin. That's apparently what, by those standards.
Yeah. I actually suspect that his account, I suspect it was by accident that it was let back on, that it was unsuspended. Because apparently it wasn't even his main account. It was one that he'd had years earlier, hadn't used since 2013 or something like that. I suspect it was not deliberate. But I do agree. It was like they did a few show unbannings and then it just fell by the wayside. But that was partly because of the ADL and Kanye West. I think that everything was looking good. And then Kanye West did that appearance on Alex Jones, and that made the ADL look right. It vindicated them. And at that point, that sort of took the wind out of Elon Musk's sails, because up until then, he'd been really taking the piss out of the ADL. I mean, he was coming out on top every time with them. They were looking ever more stupid. And then that happened.
Well, he was kind of immediately put to test in the most extreme way possible, which was a bit unfortunate in a certain sense. But if he was truly a free speech absolutist, he would have allowed Kanye to carry on, but he didn't. So obviously, there's always going to be limits to his largesse. But I'm just kind of, you know, the way that was sold to me, I thought they were going to just unban everyone and let them all back on. But obviously that hasn't been the case. But it's still better than the old regime. And in the context that we're speaking, you know, these incremental changes, they aren't even that incremental. I mean, they're pretty extreme, really, compared to, you know, the old regime where you couldn't say anything, really.
Well, I mean, the opposition certainly seem to think it's extreme. They are shitting themselves. I mean, and you know, I don't even think they should be. But for them, from their point of view, this has been a dreadful humiliation, a dreadful loss of prestige by losing the castle of Twitter.
It's a total disaster. It's a total disaster for them, because it's one of the, you know, as I say, you know, no one cares about the organs of the mainstream anymore. No one really listens to the mainstream news. Everyone kind of ignores mainstream, you know, news articles and publications. So in the battle of free ideas on Twitter, losing that was kind of, the way I describe it is, it's kind of a shell hitting the ammo dump, really. It's a kind of stray shell that's hit the ammo dump and created an inferno there where, we've kind of, the Elon phenomenon is almost something that's happened by accident in a certain sense.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I don't think that, and I made this point at the time, I don't think that Google will ever sell YouTube. I don't think that Zuckerberg's company, whatever it's called,
Meta.
I don't think it will ever sell Facebook or Instagram. But Twitter.
Well, because I think that, you know, like Meta probably got, it's not looking great. I mean, the thing about all these tech bros, in their hearts, the Jack Dorsey's and the Zuckerberg types, they didn't add anything. They're basically, they're data thieves and ad salesmen. They're not technological innovators. And, you know, now that the economy is declining and there's not the easy ad revenue and they've mined all the data and that they can do, you know, these companies are facing real issues. I mean, this Meta dream, which looks like Second Life from 10 years ago, isn't going to materialize, is it?
Oh, I don't think so. No. The confluence of factors that's playing out just now. I don't think we're going to have people spending fortunes on an NFT inside a virtual reality thing.
Apart from Trump's trading cards, of course.
Yeah, well, of course. But, you know, like, I don't think that people are going to be living in a pod 10 years from now, living their life through virtual reality and the metaverse, and trading things as NFTs. That's like, if things had gone on as they were from 2019, then I could imagine us living like that.
You're right. It's kind of an alternative timeline if the COVID world hadn't happened, or, you know, because there was, we kind of forget that there was a point where people were saying we're going to have a post-COVID bounce back, and, you know, the economy is going to grow and we're all going to carry on in that fashion. And actually, you know, we went off a cliff instead.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, move on to the next question. Rolson asks, is tribalism natural and is it the future?
Yeah, I think that we are, in a Smithian sense, co-constituted by the other. And the issue you've had in the UK is, you know, really the situation hasn't got bad enough where we were co-constituted by the other. But now, you know, people do think of themselves in that way, where they do think of themselves as white, they do think of themselves as British, because the more that we're attacked on that basis, the more it instantiates that belief. And, you know, we see this with Ukraine. You know, Ukraine probably never would have had the sense of nationalism and state that it would had if it hadn't been co-constituted by Russia attacking them. So the more that we're attacked, the more that we're going to be bounded together. So I do think that there is a certain inevitability to tribalism. I don't think that it's going to happen overnight. And I don't think that it's a kind of software, for a better word, that everyone can adopt, because some people are too far gone to believing in atomism. But yeah, I certainly do think it's natural. And I said something I want to encourage. That's when I talk about networking, and, you know, I think that's going to become more and more vital.
Yeah, I mean, I would say tribalism absolutely is natural, even among highly individualistic Northern Europeans. And this is why there is so much propaganda to discourage it, to work against it, because they need to. Because without that propaganda, our natural instincts would just reassert themselves, and we would be highly tribalistic in a way that would probably shock even most of us. As they naturally would be, I think even most of us would be shocked.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. One of the great point, and I often say that, you know, every instance where we've been allowed to vote, whether it's Brexit or instances like that, everything that's happened to us has been foisted on us. You know, even with all the heavy artillery of demoralization and, you know, blackpilling and you know, SJW woke talking points, people still went out and they still voted for Brexit. So, you know, there is this tribalistic sense that they're battling against.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, I think the last super chat is more of a statement. It's Lampshade, and he says, "It makes you wonder whether they put something in Starbucks coffee to make whites suicidal." I don't know what that was referring to. Sorry if I should have got to it at the time. But
yeah, there is something sterile and terrible about Starbucks. I mean, I don't think you'd need to put anything in the coffee.
Okay. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's part of that whole sort of bland nothingness. we're all just consumers. Yeah, it's a horrible landscape. Okay. All right. Well, I think that's everything. I don't think there are any super chats from Entropy. Yeah. Okay. That's it. So is there anything else that you'd like to say just before we finish?
Yeah, I would just like to say to everyone that we're all kind of searching for society. We're all atomized. And I do encourage people to reach out and contact me either via my website or, you know, via Twitter. I'm on Twitter as Vico Hessler. Do get out there. And, you know, you can't donate to me. I'm not asking for anyone's money particularly. I just want people to actually act and think and get out there. So that's kind of my message. You know, things do seem bad. I won't deny that they are bad, but I do think that we can make real change, and that's what I'm about, and that's kind of what I'm pushing for here.
Excellent. And Vico's essays are very good, so I would strongly recommend that people read them. And I tend to share them, most of them, when they're published on Transcendental Titans. I tend to share them on Telegram, which now goes through to Gab automatically. But yeah, it's definitely something for people to look into. And okay, well, we'll end it there. It seems that Robin Riley has had to cancel because of domestic circumstances, so that's unfortunate. There won't be another stream tonight, as far as I know. But I will be back tomorrow night with Martin Lichtmess, then Golden Age Man, then Horace, and we'll be talking about the FTX scandal, and then Gio from Giant Art Productions. So in the meantime, Vico Hessler, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 8.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks for hosting it. I know it's a huge amount of work, and thanks for giving me the platform.
Oh, you're very welcome. Okay, I'll be back tomorrow, everyone, unless anything happens tonight, which I doubt. So, okay, thank you for watching. I'll see you later. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. T-shirts and mugs and other wondrous gifts are available in the merchandise store. Impress your family, friends, colleagues, and business partners with these incredible items. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.